From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! On the 15th anniversary of the Pan Am bombing that killed 270 people, Libya announces it will abandon its nuclear program. We'll speak with the mother of one of the victims of the 1988 Pan Am bombing, who thinks the agreement is about oil. We'll also talk to an author about the decision that is being hailed by the United States and Britain. And mass detentions become commonplace in Iraq. We'll speak with two men who were jailed in Baghdad for 2 months. And is Canada's new Prime Minister, Paul Martin, leaning to the right? We'll go to Ottawa. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Libya is ready to sign a protocol allowing surprise UN inspections of its nuclear sites. This follows Friday's announcement of Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's decision to abandon all efforts to develop any chemical, biologic, and nuclear weapons. The decision reportedly followed 9 months of secret negotiations with Britain and the United States. Libya is already a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but the protocol allows for tougher, short-notice visits of nuclear sites by IAEA experts. Several states in the Middle East, including Egypt and Iran, welcomed Libya's announcement and urged Israel to follow suit by eliminating any banned weapons it may have. Agence France-Presse is reporting Egypt, Qatar, Bahrain, Algeria, and Iran have all called on Israel to scrap its nuclear arsenal. Although Israel has never confirmed or denied that it possesses weapons of mass destruction, it's been considered a nuclear power for 30 years. Egypt's government newspaper, Al Ahram, today called for an international conference aimed at ridding Middle East of mass destruction, including weapons of mass destruction, including Israel's nuclear weapons. A British newspaper, the Sunday Express, and the Kurdish news agency in Iraq are both reporting that Saddam Hussein was found last week not by the United States, but by Iraqi Kurds. The reports claim that Saddam Hussein was captured in Tikrit after he was tracked down by a Kurdish militia comprising members of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. He was then drugged and handed over to the United States, they report. The Kurdish news agency reported the U.S. insisted that his capture be made to look like an American arrest because U.S. officials worried that such a coup for the Kurds might provoke an Arab-Kurd civil war. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is reporting that the U.S. has arrested more than 200 Iraqis based in part on intelligence gained from Saddam Hussein's capture. Oil storage tanks and pipelines in Iraq have come under repeated attack in Iraq over the weekend. In southern Baghdad, about 2.6 million gallons of oil were destroyed after oil storage tanks were bombed. Pipelines near Baghdad and on as well Kirkuk were also targeted. Iraqi officials say there have now been over 85 attacks on Iraq's oil infrastructure since April, leading to a massive fuel shortage. The Iraqi oil ministry has announced a new rationing system that bars drivers from buying more than 7 gallons of gas at a time, and drivers are allowed to buy gas only on alternate days. In Kirkuk, local Iraqis are reporting U.S. forces have shot dead 3 Iraqi police officers who were mistaken to be bandits. Over 115 Iraqi police and security officers have died since April. On Sunday, Homeland Defense Secretary Tom Ridge announced the government had raised the national threat level to high risk or orange. According to Ridge, intelligence gathered by the U.S. shows the possibility of another attack by al-Qaeda is as great as at any point since September 11th. Ridge went on to warn, quote, extremists abroad are anticipating near-term attacks that they believe will either rival or exceed the attacks that occurred 2 years ago. A major Israeli newspaper is reporting that President Bush told its correspondent that, quote, we must get rid of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Bush's comments reportedly came at a Christmas party in Washington shortly after Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon called for the further isolation of the Palestinians. In other news from Israel, 15 members of Israel's top army commando unit have written to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to declare they're refusing to carry out missions in Palestinian territories. The soldiers wrote, quote, we will no longer give our lives to the rule of oppression in the territories and to the denial of human rights to millions of Palestinians, and we will no longer serve as a defensive shield for the settlements, unquote. In other news from Israel, Haaretz is reporting that the Israeli defense minister has begun publicly discussing a possible Israeli attack on Iran to destroy Iran's nuclear capability. The Israeli defense minister first discussed the attack on Israel radio. UPI reports last month a top official in Israel's spy agency Mossad described Iran's nuclear program as the biggest threat to Israel since its 1948 creation. This comes as Iran has agreed to sign a protocol of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and is expected to allow in UN inspectors. Meanwhile, the U.S. officials are reporting that Iran and North Korea have both received technology to enrich uranium from Pakistan. Evidence has emerged that implicated several of Pakistan's top nuclear scientists. 2 weeks ago, the Pakistani government detained three of them for questioning. For the second time in a month, the U.S. military's case against a Muslim accused of spying at Guantanamo Bay has largely fallen apart. Senior Airman Ahmad al-Halabi, who works as a translator with the Guantanamo detainees, originally faced 30 charges, including the capital crime of aiding the enemy. But 13 of the more serious charges have now been dropped. The main charges now deal with improperly transporting classified documents. Al-Halabi's lawyer said the military attempted to claim almost every document his client had was classified. One document, which was classified as secret, not to be viewed by non-Americans, was a photograph of Al-Halabi's fiancée, who lives in Syria. This comes weeks after the government's case against another Muslim working at Guantanamo Bay, Joseph Yusuf Yee, largely fell apart. Yee, a West Point graduate who worked as a Muslim chaplain, was held for 76 days on suspicion of spying and aiding the enemy. When charges were finally filed in October, the charges had little to do with national security. The most serious was taking classified material to his home and wrongfully transporting classified material without the proper security containers or covers. At a recent court hearing, Yee's attorney charged the government arrested him for transporting classified material, although it has yet to rule that the material in question was even classified. They also charged him with adultery. A judge in Miami has said in open court that he personally saw police officers commit at least 20 felonies during protests last month in Miami. The judge, 60-year-old Richard Margolius, said he would have been arrested himself at the demonstrations against the free trade area of the Americas had a police officer not recognized him as a judge. Margolius's comments came during the trial of two protesters after he asked state prosecutors how many police officers had been charged so far for their actions on the street. When the prosecutor said none, Margolius said that was a, quote, pretty sad commentary. Margolius continued that it was, quote, pretty disgraceful what I saw with my own eyes. He said, and I have always supported the police during my entire career. This was a real eye-opener, a disgrace for the community, unquote. The AFL-CIO, the American Civil Liberties Union, and other groups have announced plans to sue the city and Miami Police Chief John Timoney for their actions during the protests. Over 200 protesters were arrested, scores were beaten by police and shot with rubber bullets and tear gas. In related news, Miami Police Chief Timoney has begun working for the city of Boston as a security consultant for the upcoming Democratic National Convention this summer. In Bulgaria, the parliament on Friday voted to allow the U.S. to build permanent bases inside Bulgaria for the first time. The U.S. has been using a Bulgarian airport as a base for some warplanes used in Iraq and Afghanistan. An investigation by the New York Times has found that the federal agency that monitors workplace safety, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, seldom seeks to prosecute employers whose willful neglect leads to death of an employee. Over the past 20 years, over 1,200 deaths have been reported, and OSHA has declined to seek prosecution in 93% of the cases. In Paris, some 3,000 people, mostly Muslim women, took to the streets to protest the French government's decision to ban from state schools religious clothing, including Islamic headscarves. The Federal Communications Commission approved Friday the $6.6 billion purchase of satellite TV giant DirecTV by Rupert Murdoch, who runs News Corp and Fox News. According to the Los Angeles Times, the deal will make Murdoch the nation's only media titan with satellite, cable, and broadcast assets in the United States. Murdoch owns the Fox Network, Fox News Channel, 20 regional sports channels, 35 other TV stations, the New York Post, and the 20th Century Fox movie studio. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Libya is ready to sign a protocol allowing surprise UN inspections of its nuclear sites. This follows Friday's announcement of Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's decision to abandon all efforts to develop any chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. The decision reportedly followed 9 months of secret negotiations with Britain and the United States. Libya is already a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but the protocol allows for tougher, short-notice visits of nuclear sites by International Atomic Energy Agency experts. Several states in the Middle East, including Egypt and Iran, welcomed Libya's announcement and urged Israel to follow suit by eliminating any banned weapons it may have. Several papers are reporting Libya hopes to gain lucrative oil contracts blocked by U.S. sanctions, as well as reap other economic benefits from the decision. Libyan Prime Minister Shukri Ghanem told the BBC, quote, "We're turning our swords into plowshares, and this step should be appreciated and followed by all countries. The U.S. is the one country that maintains sweeping sanctions, which were imposed in 1986, accusing Libya of supporting terrorist groups." The Financial Times is reporting that Abdurrahman Shalgam, the Libyan foreign minister, told the Financial Times in September that Tripoli recognized Arabs were helpless in influencing U.S. policy, and that particularly following the Iraq War, other states considered rogue by the U.S. were coming under increased pressure. He said, why confront America? We want to rehabilitate our civil aviation industry and expand our oil investments. And for all this, we need American technology. Libya's strategic goal, he said, is to raise oil production. A return of American oil companies whose past concessions have not been given to rivals would save Libya as much as 20 cents per gallon. They have been barred from working in Libya since the U.S. bilateral sanctions were strengthened in 1986. The announcement came the day before the 15th anniversary of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, which killed 270 people. After years of denials, Gaddafi admitted to Libya's role in the bombing earlier this year. Relatives of people killed in the attack gathered at Arlington National Cemetery yesterday for a memorial service. We're joined on the phone by Andrew Lissette, who's author of Gaddafi and the Libyan Revolution. He joins us on phone from London. And we're joined by Susan Cohen. Her only daughter, Theodora, was killed in the Lockerbie bombing. Theodora was 20 years old, one of 25 students from Syracuse University were killed in the attack. Susan Cohen, let's begin with you. You're in Washington yesterday at the Arlington National Cemetery. Can you tell us your response to this announcement?
I think it's absolutely appalling, a total betrayal, and really something the oil companies have wanted for a great deal of time. I find it ironic today that I see Saddam Hussein coming out of a hole, Milosevic in court, and Muammar Gaddafi being sanctified. Jack Straw said that Gaddafi is a great statesman. Well, you know, my only child has been murdered. My life has been shattered. The blowing up of Pan Am 103 was a terrible, terrible war crime. And I'm afraid I don't see Muammar Gaddafi, dictator, tyrant, mass murderer, and terrorist, as a great statesman. So I think the smear that will be put on this is, oh, look, this is wonderful with the WMD. Look, he's going to give it up. There are two possibilities here. One is he doesn't have really very much. Let's look at what happened with Iraq. Two is that whatever he gives up, he can get again at any time that he wants once he has the wealth and technology that will flow to him when the commercial sanctions are lifted and diplomatic relations are restored. And I really think that this is a very, very bad thing. It's just the bad guys getting away with it again. That's all this is. This is not in any way this great step forward that it's going to have to be shown. I would like to point out that President Bush was not with the families yesterday, has not shown any compassion. In his statement, he praised Gaddafi. He certainly didn't show any sympathy for us. And I think if you look at the oil guys and you look at that, that is a true story of what is going on. It is about making money. That Gaddafi should be there. And that the very people who helped to plan the bombing were involved in the planning and the working out of this deal to bring everyone together really does show what a farce and a fraud our whole war on terrorism is.
Andrew Lissette, author of Gaddafi and the Libyan Revolution, what is your take on what has now been announced, the surprise announcement on Friday by President Bush?
Well, I can't deny the main thrust of what Susan Cohen says, in that I think it's a time for being on our guard, in the sense that Gaddafi remains this mercurial, dangerous character. But on the other hand, where I have to disagree with her is that there is this opportunity to make a sort of way forward in the Middle East. And there's somebody who now, by all accounts, and also by logic almost, is not a great threat to the world. There is a country with something like 5 million people. It's always been a country that even in its sort of heyday, when it really was a dangerous threat to European security, at least in the 1980s. It was always a country that could be slapped down, and that's what America did very easily in the 1980s. Since then, Gaddafi has gone underground almost, or gone to ground is what I mean to say, and that he's been sort of rethinking his take on the world. He's been, well, certainly after the American raids on Tripoli, he was very depressed. Okay, he did come up with the Lockerbie bombing, that atrocious incident. But Gaddafi's been, in the last few years, been looking for a way back into the world community, and I think the United States and Britain are right to at least go some way to meeting him and to see what he has to offer.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. Susan Cohen, then we'll return to you. We're talking about the surprise announcement on Friday by President Bush that Muammar Gaddafi, the leader of Libya, has agreed to do away with any development of weapons of mass destruction. This right on the anniversary, the 15th anniversary of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Stay with us. I'm lucky. John Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. So we talk about the surprise announcement that Libya has agreed to not develop weapons of mass destruction, the announcement made by President Bush on Friday. We're joined on the phone by Andrew Lissette, author of Gaddafi and the Libyan Revolution, and Susan Cohen. Her only child, Theodora, was killed in the Lockerbie bombing. She was 20 years old, one of the Syracuse University group of students who were killed in that bombing. Susan Cohen, you wanted to respond to Andrew Lissette.
You know, I get pretty sick of this kind of talk. There used to be a lot of this kind of talk in the days of Hitler, you know, peace in our time. Muammar Gaddafi blew up an American plane. And may I point out, no WMD very much was involved in that. That was a little Semtex, as on 9/11 we had a few planes. I don't want to hear that suddenly, now this man is ready to change. He's first, you know, ready to change his ways. There are some crimes that are totally unforgivable. And, you know, there are some tyrants who are really not to be tolerated. So I am sorry. I don't care whether Gaddafi has been made for the moment somewhat too fearful or wanting to get all his, you know, what does he want? He wants to get a lot richer. That doesn't represent much of a change. You do not have a foreign policy where you turn around and you reward someone like this, and that you can come back from an act like that. If we have a war on terrorism, and maybe some of the people who listen to this don't really want a war on terrorism, but one was brought to our shores. If you have a war on terrorism, you don't have policies of appeasement like this. You got 9/11 in part because of this kind of policy. I am sorry. Muammar Gaddafi is a murderer. He is the worst one there. There is nothing that was done to us by Saddam Hussein that equals what Gaddafi did. So no, I'm sorry. I don't think that just because he wants to turn around now and make money with the oil boys, that is reason enough for us to do this, for the Western democracies to cave as they did with Hitler and
now,
say, well, it's okay.
Recently, Muammar Gaddafi agreed to what settlement, both for the for you, the families of the victims of the Lockerbie bombing, and also the negotiation that's been going on with French victims?
Well, I can tell you that that deal on the money is... My husband and I took the money from the lifting of the UN sanctions. There was in the UN resolution, there was a place for that. That should have been the end of that. The deal that was worked out was absolutely disgusting. It involved paying the families $4 million when commercial sanctions were lifted and $2 million if he gets off the terrorism list. I'd like to point out that I am not taking that. We are giving up a possible $6 million because there is no way that the families should be rewarded for that. That is simply blackmail. It shows you what Gaddafi really is. What would that do except buy our silence? That's all it was meant to do, to say, here, if we get off this list and we get our sanctions lifted, here for you is an incentive to keep your mouth shut or to applaud this. We'll make you rich. That shows you what this is all about. And the U.S. government, the British government were involved in that. That is what we are talking about. That is what we are dealing with. And it is absolutely, absolutely unacceptable. And another sign of why we can't do this, do we never, ever learn. It would not surprise me that perhaps in 15 years Osama bin Laden will be visiting, you know, an anniversary of 9/11 with policies like this.
Let me ask you.
Some things are unforgivable.
Andrew Lissette, I wanted to talk about Libya's relationship with U.S. oil companies and what this will mean. Libya has had the support of U.S. oil companies, which have been lobbying to return to the country and secure the concessions that come to an end next year. They've been barred from working in Libya since the U.S. bilateral sanctions were strengthened in 1986. I'd also like you to talk about the son of Muammar Gaddafi, who played a key role here, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi.
Well, as you say, there's a couple of questions there. In the American oil companies have traditionally played a very important part in the underpinning of the Libyan oil industry. They're not by no means the only players. The Italians are big players in some countries from Eastern Europe as well. But when it comes to the oil industry, it is actually a matter not just of lifting the oil, it's a matter of providing equipment, etc. And that's where American companies are prominent players, and they will gain considerably when somewhat down the line still the sanctions are completely lifted. As for Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, he has emerged in the last couple of years as very credible, I have to say, spokesperson for the Libyan regime in the wider world. He is Gaddafi's eldest son. He's age 31. I've met him. He seems to be an educated man. I mean, he's tainted in a way by being the son of the dictator, but he's put out feelers to the West, he's run a charity in Tripoli with branches elsewhere, which has been concerned with human rights. Now, this I take with a pinch of salt, I have to admit. I mean, it's done various sort of operations, such as negotiating release of hostages in the Philippines. Well, I don't think there was much negotiating going on there. I think there was quite some money paid to the right people. And Libya and Saif al-Islam got a bit of publicity from that. But nevertheless, he is a man who is now, in a way, presented as a possible a successor to his father. I mean, this may sound very odd in a a country where Gaddafi still stresses that everybody has a say in every decision. You know, there's this rhetoric, which I must admit, when I used to visit Libya, used to drive me mad about the revolutionary committees and how they had decisions in everything. And there's no doubt about it that the decisions are made at the top, and that Gaddafi is the man in control. And you know, all this stuff about the third universal theory, etc., that Gaddafi has put into his green book is a load of codswallop, really. But nevertheless, it has to be said that in the last half dozen years, when Gaddafi has been looking for a way back into the good books of the West, and has realized that in order to do that, that he's realized that his economy has been suffering, and that he's got to find some way to get his oil industry working.
Listen to much more of this mealy-mouthed apology. Gaddafi's son, a chip off the old block, who said that the Jews and that the Crusaders are trying to destroy the Muslims. I mean, you say this about Gaddafi. Gaddafi knew, probably ordered the bombing. You visited Libya. I've just had enough of this kind of person who goes around and tries to whitewash this. Do you know what I'm talking about when I say that my innocent only child got on an airplane studying abroad and was blown out of the sky? Now, you asked yourself about the man who did this. I have heard your kind of talk. It is the talk of worm tongue. We will never stop hearing it. It is absolutely meaningless. Now, when a leader of a country blows up an American plane,
there is no way
that those people who did it, and it's the same regime, it hasn't changed, can possibly
be
rehabilitated. And all of this kind of talk, this schmoozing around and all of this, which is, I guarantee you, basically is simply meant in the end for the oil companies to get their money. I mean, let's not mess around. Is absolutely immoral and despicable and mealy-mouthed platitudes. That's all it is. So, I mean, let's not pretend we're just having this nice little intellectual discussion here about Libya. There are things that are beyond acceptance in this world.
Susan Cohn,
this is one of them.
Do you accept one thing, that Gaddafi is almost now a sort of historical figure? I mean, you know, the world has moved on from the 1980s.
He's not gone, and his son is exactly like him. There's no change in a regime, is there? So, I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same person. And if you look closely at what happened with the United States and Britain and Libya on this, It is a really shameful, shameful thing. It is shameful to the core. I mean, you're not talking here to somebody who's just sitting in a college classroom going to talk about this. You're talking to somebody whose kid is dead and died because of this man. What did she ever do? She never did had anything to do with politics. He just blew up that plane. He'll now be richer. He will be more powerful. He will have more technology. And, you know, he'll then be in a very good position to do more terrorism if he wants. But whether he ever did it or not, if the United States of America is seriously to protect itself against terrorism, it cannot make deals with the Gaddafis of this world. If it doesn't have a war with them, it doesn't have to embrace them. So let's understand this, what this is really all about.
I wanted to, in continuing to talk about nuclear politics, to switch gears for a moment, because on Thursday, Iran agreed to allow UN inspectors into the country to examine suspected nuclear sites there. The announcement came one day before Libya announced it would scrap its arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. Iran signed a portion of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and vowed that its atomic program was for peaceful purposes. The U.S. praised the move but said it was only a first step. Iran's claim that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes contradicts reports coming out of Pakistan. 2 weeks ago, the Pakistani government detained three top nuclear scientists after evidence emerged that indicated they might have given Iran and North Korea technology to enrich uranium. In Israel, the newspaper Haaretz is reporting that the defense minister has begun publicly discussing a possible Israeli attack on Iran to destroy Iran's nuclear capability. The defense minister first discussed the attack on Israeli radio. Last month, a top official in Israel's spy agency Mossad described Iran's nuclear program as the biggest threat to Israel since its creation in 1948. In addition to Susan Cohen and Andrew Lassette, author of Gaddafi and the Libyan Revolution, we're joined by Professor Evand Abrahamian, who is a Middle East and Iran expert at Baruch College, part of the City University of New York. And I wanted to get your take on this latest news.
Yes, good morning. Well, it's nothing new because Israel has been actually pointing fingers at Iran for now the last 10 years. You hear voices in Israel saying Iran was more even dangerous than Iraq. There were some people in Israel who were arguing that U.S. should have gone after Iran before Iraq. So it's this fits into the sort of the same script that we heard a long time about Iraq, and I think it's just there's concern now in Israel that since U.S. has more than its plate full in Iraq, it's not going to be that concerned about Iran. So there is, I think, pressure from Israel to get the United States to refocus on Iran. And the script that I see similar with Iraq is that while the UN and Europeans are willing to negotiate and basically have a dialogue to get Iran to slow down or dismantle its nuclear weaponry program, the pressure from Israel and the United States is whatever UN does, it's not good enough. And if the inspectors don't find anything, that doesn't mean anything, that the only way to do it is by what the euphemism would be, a regime change. So the bottom line is basically you can't negotiate. The only safe way is regime change. So it's the same script we heard for 2 years over Iraq now being redone on Iran.
And do you have any comments about the latest developments in Libya and how they may relate to Iran?
No, I don't. I think they're completely separate. Gaddafi for years has been trying to basically mend his bridges with Europe, especially not so much United States, and part of the deal was this. And there's another aspect, of course. I think Gaddafi has been very worried and has been targeted by religious fanatics. And he has as much vested in getting rid of bin Laden as United States. There's an inside story which I don't think has ever really been covered here, but it's been pretty well covered in Britain, which is that years ago, bin Laden tried to assassinate Gaddafi, and Gaddafi's been trying to extradite from Britain, actually, one of bin Laden's operatives. But the British don't want to let him go, because at that time, the British were actually cooperating with bin Laden to get rid of Gaddafi. So there is a sort of a great deal of irony in this.
Can you explain that further, Professor Abrahamian? I think a few eyebrows were just raised.
Oh, yes. It's been covered pretty well in the British Guardian. There was, before bin Laden turned his focus on United States and Israel, he was in fact targeting, obviously, the Soviet Union, and he considered Gaddafi as an ally of the Soviet Union. So he was, in fact, trying to assassinate him. And it was done through his operatives in London.
And
at that time, the British also had an interest in getting rid of Gaddafi.
Andrew Lassette, have you written about this history?
I'm sort of, raising my eyebrows a bit about this as well. I mean, certainly, at a certain stage, there was a British plot to assassinate Gaddafi. We know about that. We know about the Islamic attacks on Gaddafi. I mean, this has been a running theme throughout his regime, throughout his, you know, his period in office. I mean, he's now been there for extraordinarily over 30 years, and right from the beginning, you know, there have been Islamic groups that have targeted him, and he's had to crack down on them. I mean, similar story in some respects in Algeria, and I guess you could almost say also say in Egypt. And this is part of the story, I think, that that Gaddafi is now in the, I have to say, changed circumstances of the moment. He is a sort of ally of the West, if you like, against revolutionary Islamic groups, including Al-Qaeda.
Well, I don't think that justifies any relationship, because that is, so what? I mean, I can't see where Al-Qaeda is any worse than Gaddafi. My daughter would be alive if one of those groups had gotten Gaddafi. So I'm not as entirely against this regime change that you all think is so horrible.
Susan Cohen, I have a question, and that is, you said that President Bush was not with you and the other families of the Lockerbie disaster, the bombing of the Pan Am flight 15 years ago that you took place yesterday.
The important thing that has to be done is to get Pan Am, as far as this administration is concerned, is to make Pan Am a 103 disappear. Because that's what Gaddafi also wants. Let's close the book on it. Total full respectability. We never did this awful thing. It didn't happen. And
do
that's
you
what
represent,
Bush is part of.
Let me ask, do you represent the majority view of the families of the survivors?
I think that most of the families just think this is yummy ducky. They don't. Now, I can't speak for everyone. There are obviously going to be varying opinions. The people I talked to all agreed with me, and the mood yesterday it's never happy. I mean, the 15th anniversary of the time our children died is not a happy day, wherever it is. But the mood was not good in Washington. People felt, a number of them, betrayed.
Have most of the families taken the deal that was offered?
I believe most have, because that's how people are. I mean, that's what money does. However, they are not happy with it. They're just not going to turn down chunks of money. I feel so strongly about it, I can. Gaddafi's bought an awful lot of people in his life. He buys a lot of people, a lot of academics, a lot of all kinds of people, a lot of people who will say all kinds of things and do all kinds of things. I have very little left in my life which has been destroyed, but one thing he's not going to do is he's not going to buy me. And really, I will not take the extra millions, because I'm just not going to do that.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you all for being with us. Susan Cohen lost her daughter Theodora 15 years ago in the Lockerbie bombing. Theodora was 20 years old, a Syracuse University student. Andrew Lissette has been with us from London, author of Gaddafi and the Libyan Revolution, and Professor Irvand Abrahamian, a Middle East and Iran expert at Baruch College, City University of New York. When we come back from our break, we're heading north to Canada. There's a new prime minister. We'll talk about his politics. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. That was Duke Ellington. Canada's former finance minister, Paul Martin, was sworn in as prime minister earlier this month. Martin replaces Jean Chrétien, who headed up the Liberal Party as prime minister for 10 years. Martin has announced his aim to strengthen Canada's international standing, particularly in relations with the United States. He's appointed David Pratt as defense minister, who urged the previous government to join the invasion of Iraq. Pratt is expected to be an articulate advocate for increasing the military budget. Prime Minister Martin visited the Department of National Defense headquarters after only 3 days in office, while the former Prime Minister Chrétien never set foot in the building for 10 years. At Mr. Martin's swearing-in ceremony on December 12th, a native Canadian elder conducted a cleansing ceremony, complete with burning sage, as a sign that the government would change course. We're joined on the phone right now by Tony Clark, director of the Polaris Institute based in Ottawa. Can you talk about the new prime minister and where you expect him to take the country and how he compares to the former prime minister, Chrétien?
Yes, well, you know, when you look back on the Liberal convention, which was the last one that Jean Chrétien spoke to, he made it very clear. He sent out a warning to the Liberal Party about being aware and beware of the rise of the right within the party. And he looked right at Paul Martin when he said that, and it's kind of like reminiscent of the warnings that Dwight Eisenhower gave, I guess, as he was leaving office about the military-industrial complex. And I say that simply because the Martin himself has become quite clear about his position on the military front. He does favor much closer cooperation with the United States on this. He sees himself as, you know, substantially increasing the military spending of the Canadian government on military matters, and he wants to see Canada join the American National Missile Defense System. So we're likely to see a major shift in that direction towards increased military spending and military buildup as far as the United States is concerned. And this is all part of a whole attempt to develop a new political agenda between the United States, between Canada and the United States, beyond free trade into things that deal with military security, homeland security, and energy security in the future.
Can you talk about the whole issue of globalization and where Canada fits in? Canada, the United States, and Mexico signing NAFTA 9 years ago, almost 10 years ago, and how Martin compares to Chrétien. You're a well-known anti-corporate globalization activist in Canada.
Well, you know, I think what's happened is that now that the axis has been certainly fairly well formed in terms of free trade on the continent, the question is how to move forward from here. And it's more than just free trade in the sense of goods and services going across borders now, although that's still a part of the agenda. The question is how to secure those borders and how to make sure that this power base that's been built in terms of the economy expands throughout the Americas and elsewhere in the world. And that means that from the standpoint of some people, and I think in this case many of the Martinites, is that they need to consolidate this relationship with the Bush administration and with the United States in order to be able to further expand Canada's role in the world. And Martin, in many ways, sees, I think, Canada's future very much lying in terms of a stronger relationship with the United States. And the point I'm making is that that's going to come at a different price. It's not just a question of more goods and services going across borders and things like that. It's going to be making sure that we're in there playing a very active role with the United States on the military front. It means beefing up and really coordinating and consolidating our homeland security with that of the United States. And furthermore, it means making sure that Canada is the constant guaranteed supplier of energy outside of the United States.
Looking at a New York Times piece from Saturday, it says Mr. Martin said he would push ahead with legislation to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana, but with higher penalties than those proposed by Chrétien. He dodged questions about same-sex marriage. Chrétien strongly backed appeals court decisions in Ontario and British Columbia allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry and proposed legislation to make the expansion of marriage rights nationwide. Martin says he'll broaden consideration of the issue before Parliament voted on a marriage law. He suggested he would ask the Supreme Court for its opinion on whether granting gay and lesbian couples civil union rights rather than full marriage rights would be constitutional. Legal scholars doubt that the Supreme Court would approve any law falling short of total equality.
Well, there again, you know, in terms of the other kind of social issues that are on the horizon that that the Chrétien government put in front of them, that Martin now has to deal with, it's interesting to see that he's going to the position he may take on marijuana on same-sex marriage. I think that's reflecting Martin's position is largely reflecting his. His certain perspective as a Roman Catholic from that angle, and he is definitely wanting to make a separation between civil marriage and marriage that's conducted under religious ceremony, and he wants to be able to retain those distinction between those two in order to avoid what he thinks is going to be a major conflict that he will have to face. So I think that he's backing off of those kinds of directions that I think the certainly the Chrétien government was in the legacy that Jean Chrétien was trying to leave as far as those social matters are concerned.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Tony Clark, director of the Polaris Institute based in Ottawa. And we're going to take that last issue back here to the United States. While right now a lot of headlines are about Saddam Hussein, or about Iraq, about the occupation, about the loss of U.S. soldiers in Iraq, it may well be, but by the time of the U.S. election for president, that one of the major issues will be the issue of gay marriage. Many people, George Bush included, talking about a constitutional amendment that would ban marriage between two men or two women. Well, today in New Jersey, a notice of appeal will be filed before the state's appellate court. Before the state's appellate court, in a case that seems likely to be headed to the New Jersey Supreme Court, that asks for rights and responsibilities that go along with government-sanctioned matrimony. We're joined right now by two of the people who are among the seven plaintiffs in the New Jersey lawsuit seeking same rights for gay couples as heterosexual couples. Sandra Heath and Alicia Toby join us on the phone from New Jersey. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Good morning.
And it's Alicia.
Alicia,
yeah.
Can you explain what this the significance of today is, what exactly you're doing in this lawsuit?
Well, we're proceeding to the next stage. We expected to lose in the first part of the lawsuit on the lower level. So now we're excited and anxious as well as we move on to the next stage. It's moving right along, so we're just anticipating, you know, what the final decision is going to be.
The New Jersey legislature is expected to approve two bills that would provide some domestic partner benefits to same-sex couples. Where does Governor James McGreevy stand?
You want to take that, baby? Right now, I don't really know where he stands. I think that he probably would lean more toward a domestic partnership, if anything, as opposed to legally sanctioning same-sex marriage. But I'm not really sure where he stands in this position.
I think where we stand on it is that it's exciting, but needless to say that it's very limited in the benefits that it lends same-sex marriages. We certainly are in support of it. It's a step toward the right direction. And it's not only limited to same-sex marriage or, you know, to lesbian and gay folk. It's inclusive of any couples that want to be together and benefit from medical benefits and stuff. So it's very exciting, but it's limited, and so we are glad about it, but certainly forging ahead on the legalization of same-sex marriage.
If the legislature approves bills that recognize some tax, property, insurance benefits for same-sex couples, at this point, you have none?
No, we have none.
No.
You have two grown boys and grandchildren?
Yes, we have four grandchildren. You hear one of them in the background. she's with us this morning. But we have four grandchildren, four grandbabies, actually. They were all babies, and two grown sons. But you know, we don't enjoy any of the legal protections that a heterosexual couple who is married, as we are, enjoy. So for us, legalizing, recognizing same-sex marriage is a primary concern for us.
How long have you been together?
We've been together. It would be 15 years in January.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If one of you had to go to the hospital, how would the other partner be considered?
Well, we would just be considered what happens is my wife has been to the hospital twice with having major surgery, and I identified myself as being her wife, her spouse. Of course, it's not legally recognized, but fortunately for us, the hospital did not give me a hard time about visitation and her first surgery. Her doctor came to the waiting room to get me and take me to her in recovery. So we've been very blessed as, you know, being given respect. You know, no one has tried to mistreat us or when she was in the hospital both times, make me feel insignificant, you know. But still, the day could happen where that might be an issue, you know, where if I said that she was my wife or we've been together so many years, they may look at me and say, and? You know what I mean? So, but that hasn't happened to us, but the possibility of it happening is real for us.
And what is your response to this election year where a constitutional amendment that would put into the Constitution, make it illegal for same-sex couples to marry, could be considered, could gain strength, even as the movement going in the other direction gains strength, as we've seen in Massachusetts and now in New Jersey?
It's appalling. And it's appalling because there are a number of issues. One, it's a civil right and human rights issue. And we as taxpayers and viable citizens deserve the right to be able to marry those that we love. And so it's absurd to think that George Bush and the powers that be could actually ban same-sex marriage.
Sandra Heath and Alicia Toby, I want to thank you for being with us. Among the seven couple plaintiffs in New Jersey lawsuits seeking the same rights for gay couples that go along with government-sanctioned marriage. And that does it for the program. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pravesh Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.